Thank you, Dr. Thomas, for the privilege of delivering this year's Bynum Tudor lecture. And thank you for your very kind words of introduction. Can I say also that I echo your words about Mr. Bynum Tudor? I've had the privilege of discussing many matters with him, including the focus of this lecture. And I know him to be a man of immense vision and with a great passion for education. And I too wish him a complete and speedy recovery. Well, most of my time is spent in the world of industry, and very little of it in lecture theatres like this. So for me, places like this are special. Always when I walk into a lecture theatre, I'm taken back in time, just for a fleeting moment, to when, as a 14-year-old schoolboy, I was taken to an Institution of Electrical Engineers Faraday lecture. It was a lecture intended for young people, although the prospect of an evening's lecture after a hard day's schooling was never likely to fill me with unalloyed enthusiasm. But my father, who himself was an engineer, was quietly insistent, and he and I went. That Faraday lecture changed the course of my life. It was given by an engineer from the UK Atomic Energy Authority. He talked about the science, the engineering, and his way of life as an engineer. And the more he talked, the more spellbound I became. His way of life, the engineer's way of life, was the way of life I wanted for myself. There and then, I resolved to become an engineer. Well, that was 42 years ago. In some ways, though, it seems only yesterday. But just one glance at the slide rule lying idly in my desk drawer is enough to remind me of just how many years have passed by since then. And of how many times in my career I've bumped into Faraday, so to speak. Now, I don't mean his ghost, though I'm bound to confess that being alone at the dead of night in the Institution of Electrical Engineers, ancient and labyrinthine premises in London, where the institution imprisons its presidents so that they're fresh for duty the following morning, well, rather does fire the imagination. Rather, I mean that every modern engineering adventure seems to track back to Faraday. Faraday's discovery of electromagnetic induction in 1831 made it possible to generate electricity continuously. Without that discovery, there would be no electrical engineering. And in telecommunications, for example, one of the fathers of telegraphy, William Cook, consulted Faraday about why his prototype didn't work very well. Faraday encouraged him, and he succeeded. And that was in 1836. 8 years later, in 1844, Faraday solved the problem of how to insulate submarine telegraph cables. He suggested a substance called gutta percha, made from the gum of the Malayan percha tree, and it was the forerunner of rubber. Then he turned his attention to the relationship between electricity, magnetism, and light. The work he did in 1845 led him to theorize that if light traveled in waves, then so must electromagnetism. In doing so, Faraday laid the foundations for radio communications of all sorts, from broadcast to mobile phones. And then in 1852, when Faraday investigated the discharge of electricity through rarefied gases, he paved the way for cathode ray tubes and television. How do you describe somebody who makes contributions like those and countless more besides? Well, in the vocabulary of the 19th century, he was a natural philosopher. In today's terminology, what would we call him? A scientist? Yes. An experimental scientist rather than a theoretical scientist? Probably. An engineer? Maybe. An innovator? Certainly. Because he did different things, and he did things differently. And for me, that's the very essence of innovation. Both doing different things and doing things differently. By doing different things and by doing things differently, Michael Faraday changed his world. He changed our world. And he changed our world's future. Well, innovation is much on our minds today as we strive to change the economic fortunes of our companies, our universities, and our country. We know that our future prosperity depends on increasing the rate and relevance of our innovations. But how to do that in a world which is very different from Faraday's, a world which is very different because of Faraday? And that's the issue on which I'd like to reflect this evening. Innovation in the information age. And I'd like to begin with the relationship between innovation and economic growth. It's a cyclical relationship, of course, in which innovation is linked to economic growth by competitive advantage. New and improved products and processes enable us to outsell our competitors. And part of the wealth generated can be ploughed back into creating even better products and processes. Those better products and processes increase our advantage in the market. We become wealthier still and invest yet more in innovation. Every cycle leaves us better off than the last. But if only it were that easy. Driving that cycle so that the result is growth, not decline, depends on uncovering the hidden connections between innovation and competitive advantage and economic growth and innovation, and then managing those connections actively. At the root of all the technological and economic discontinuities, which in combination are so profound that we think of them as ushering in a new age, the information age, is connectedness. I imagine that every one of us in this room has a personal computer and an email address and a mobile phone, and that we use our mobile phones not just for talking and listening, but for text and graphic messages too. Consider that in the UK, on Valentine's Day each year, the number of Valentine's messages that we send as text messages on mobile phones outnumbers the cards we send through the post by 6-1. Today's lovelorn don't stay at home waiting for the postman to call or sit by the phone waiting for it to ring, because their phone and their letterbox are in their pockets, wherever they are. Add the economic dimension to the human dimension, and it's likely that the historians of the future will regard texting as a defining phenomenon of telecommunications at the start of the 21st century. Our personal computers, the internet and the World Wide Web, and our mobile phones have changed the way that we as individuals live our lives. And we can imagine that lifestyle-changing potential scaled up to universities, companies, governments, voluntary organizations, so on. In industry, for example, if the word globalization had existed before it was coined only a couple of decades or so ago, it would have meant simply the increasing cross-border flows of goods and capital. Now, globalization refers also to the cross-border flows of intellectual property. For some companies, their intellectual property, the knowledge which is the essence of their competitive advantage, may be their most valuable asset. And in the information age, they're able to move that asset around the world at the speed of light. Now, that's great for companies because it gives them more operational flexibility. But it presents new challenges for countries because when knowledge can be moved so much more easily, the international mobility of the tangible assets which add value to that knowledge is greater. So, intuitively, it must matter less to inward investors like Motorola where in the world we put our tangible assets, mustn't it? No. The good news is that it matters more, not less. In the information age, inward investors seek to be in countries where they can innovate, where they can do things differently and do different things most productively. And one of the things that doing that depends on is connectedness. First, because connectedness reduces cycle times. Of course, cycle times have been getting faster for a long time. Take consumer electronics. When television was launched, it was 20 years before there were 1 million viewers. The second cycle to colour television was twice as fast, 10 years to 1 million viewers. Video cassette recorders, 8 years. Personal computers, 5 years. Mobile phones, just 3 years. That was then, when mobile phones were analog. Now, in today's digitally connected world, we've got to change the scales to measure cycle time meaningfully. The first 1 billion mobile phones were connected in 12 years. The second 1 billion in 2.5 years. And that's typical of what's happening to cycle times in the information age. The second way in which connectedness increases the rate of innovation is that it enables scientists, engineers, and technologists, indeed all of us, to work at higher levels of abstraction. For an example, let's just look at the impact on just one profession, the profession that I know best, engineering. We engineers have always worked in the abstract, of course. How else could any of the pioneers of my profession, from Faraday onwards, have completed so many projects in one working lifetime? And could we ourselves, today's engineers, ever complete anything if we had to master every detail? To come to terms with the increasing richness of engineering and its increasingly interdisciplinary nature, we have to work at a level of abstraction. The development of software engineering depended on recognizing that truth. Fred Brooks, a fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering, published a seminal book in 1975 called The Mythical Man Month, in which he wrote, "The programmer," that's what software engineering was called then, "the programmer, like the poet, works only slightly removed from pure thought stuff. He builds his castles in the air, from air, creating by exertion of the imagination." That was more than a quarter of a century ago, when software engineers had workstations and hardware engineers had benches. Things have changed. Now, hardware engineers, indeed all engineers, are much more likely to have a workstation than a bench. Now we're all building castles in the air, from air. And we're building those castles so fast that we can complete the engineering of one product and move on to the design of the next product before the physical realization of the first product is even built and tested. Well, why wait? For us, the first product existed already. We developed it and rigorously tested it in cyberspace. With our final keystroke, we brought it into being. Time to move on to the next engineering challenge. So abstraction and cycle time are related. The higher is the level of abstraction, the shorter is the cycle time. And since cycles present opportunities for us to learn and make process changes, every cycle drives up the level of abstraction a little higher. So a feedback loop is set up with a gain of more than one. The result is ever-increasing abstraction and ever-reducing cycle time. No wonder the engineering profession has seen so much change in so few years. And I'm confident that an engineer in any discipline could make that same observation, because engineering is becoming more interdisciplinary, and increasing interdisciplinarity is another effect of information age connectedness. The increasingly interdisciplinary nature of engineering is clearly evident in some fields, like energy, transport, and defence, where the system-level boundaries between electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, and software engineering are becoming harder to discern. The trend is just as strong, though, in all the other emerging fields of nanobiotechnology and so on. Engineers in every field know that as many breakthroughs happen at disciplinary boundaries and between disciplinary boundaries as happen within disciplines. The fourth way in which increasing innovation depends on connectedness is that information age connectedness enables us to collaborate much more widely than ever before. Michael Faraday recognized the importance of working collaboratively. He understood that no one person can possess the full complement of knowledge or skills to make profoundly important advances. It's hard, probably impossibly hard, to innovate alone. Faraday's relationship with another great man of his age, James Clerk Maxwell, provides us with a good illustration. Faraday was a great experimentalist, perhaps the greatest experimentalist. But by his own admission, he was no mathematician. Yet he knew that ultimately, the further development of his ideas about the relationship between electricity, magnetism, and light would depend on being able to describe that relationship mathematically. Well, Maxwell did just that. With 58 pages of closely written equations, and Faraday's warm response in a letter to Maxwell spoke volumes. I was at first frightened when I saw such mathematical force made to bear upon the subject, and then wondered to see that the subject stood it so well. The tonality of an innovative partnership, collaboration, not competition, is so important. Faraday and Maxwell set the standard for us all. Faraday's interactions with Maxwell and his other contemporaries were productive, undoubtedly. Yet imagine how productive they might have been if they'd been many to many, not one to one. If they'd happened in real time, not at the speed of horses and steamships, and if they'd been truly spontaneous. Collaborative brainstorming as we know it was simply not possible with 19th century networking technologies. Now, in the information age, it's different. The last two or three decades have seen a veritable explosion in the number and complexity of collaborations. In the telecommunications standards arena, for instance, companies are collaborating with other companies and with universities and are creating global standards in record cycle times. Take the Bluetooth wireless standard. It's used to replace cables for linking devices over short distances. Earpieces can be connected to mobile phones. Mobile phones can be connected to laptop computers. And laptop computers can be connected to printers and to a great deal else. More than 2,500 organizations participated in the standardization of Bluetooth. Yet the process took only a very few years, from the first idea in the late 1990s to a multi-billion dollar global market now. A specific, relatively short-term goal like Bluetooth is not essential for a successful collaboration. Some effective collaborations are based on long-term, broadly based goals. The GSM Association is a global trade association for the digital mobile phone industry. Its expressed primary aim is to accelerate the implementation of collectively identified, commercially prioritized operator requirements. In other words, it aims to accelerate innovation. The membership of the GSM Association consists of more than 620 mobile operators and 140 manufacturers and suppliers. So that's at least 760 companies. And seemingly, no universities. Which strikes me as wrong, because I think universities should engage with industry at all levels. The more closely coupled is the collaboration between industry and academe, the more productive it's likely to be. For industry's part, when it enters into collaborative partnerships with academe, it does so not only to accelerate, not only to access the knowledge being generated by people working at the frontiers of scientific and engineering research. Industry looks to universities for three other things too. First, it looks for thinking which is not distracted by the exigencies of the business, not constrained by conventional wisdom. Thinking which is unafraid to be counterintuitive, and which may, in consequence, be discontinuous. Second, industry asks its academic partners to look further into the technological future than industry does, to map that technological landscape that lies ahead of industry's headlights. And third, industry expects to find in universities not just learned practitioners, but potential leaders who can take tomorrow's teams ahead of the headlights, not just once, but again and again. These partnership qualities in combination, counterintuitive thinking, getting ahead of the headlights, and tomorrow's leaders, enable the discontinuous breakthroughs on which accelerating the rate of innovation so often depends. Not least because the breakthroughs which have the potential for discontinuous change rarely come from the industries that they change. The railway industry didn't invent the internal combustion engine. The telephone industry didn't invent the internet. The post office didn't invent emails. So established industries that can both create discontinuities and then go on to exploit them are few and far between. Individual companies that can do so are even fewer and further between. That's another reason why collaborative partnerships are so important within industries and with other industries, with other companies and with universities. So information age connectedness shortens cycle times, increases the level of abstraction at which we can work, enables more interdisciplinarity, widens collaborations, and helps to bring about discontinuous breakthroughs. The more use we make of information age connectedness, the greater will be the rate at which we can innovate. That's why broadband matters so much. We should think of the broadband socket on the wall not as giving us a broadband connection to the internet, but as giving us a broadband connection to competitive advantage. Then surely we'd all have one, and we'd all use it. The common denominator of all competitive advantage is knowledge. It's putting knowledge to work that generates competitive advantage. Yet the competitive value of knowledge erodes over time, so the advantage is not sustainable. Therefore, industrial success depends on finding ever faster ways of learning and doing. Indeed, I'm more than ever convinced that the rate at which we learn and do will become the last sustainable source of competitive advantage. Traditionally, we've acquired knowledge and improved our skills by reading, by going on courses, by attending seminars and conferences, and by talking to those around us. But this classic approach has serious limitations. Reading published materials can't substitute for dialogue with fellow professionals. So we organise conferences and seminars. But attendances at the best organised of them are limited by the practical considerations of place and time. The arrangements don't work for everyone. Indeed, they don't work for most people. And for the fortunate few who can attend, the learning experience lacks immediacy. Worst of all, from an industrial perspective, these traditional methods of learning are slow because they're based on a learn and then do model of the learning process. Really rapid learning happens when we learn and do at the same time. The information age allows us to engage in simultaneous learning and doing on an unprecedented scale. So much so that the distinction between learning and doing is becoming increasingly difficult to discern. For instance, when we went to the library or attended a course or a conference, we were going to a place set aside for learning at a time set aside for learning. Then, armed with our new knowledge, we'd return to our place of work to put into practice what we'd learned. Instead of going to the library to find the latest published thinking in their field, today's information age engineers are just as likely to search for their knowledge online. The Institution of Engineering and Technology's InSpec database, for instance, is a repository of about 10 million abstracts, growing by about 1,000 abstracts every day. We engineers can search it from our desks on the spur of the moment, as often as we like. It's a world of knowledge just a few keystrokes away, knowledge that we can put to immediate use. Now, is that learning or is that doing? Information age technologies are enabling us to solve the immediacy problem associated with conferences too. The Institution of Engineering and Technology's web-based networks allow engineers all around the world to share their knowledge informally, interactively, almost conversationally. They allow them to do so with all the immediacy of the internet, a medium which was made possible by the inventiveness of the engineering profession. The institution's professional networks began only a few years ago, yet already they're used by many tens of thousands of people all around the globe. Web-based networks are not substitutes for face-to-face meetings, of course. They complement them. And when engineers integrate their participation in web-based networks with their regular working day, are they learning or are they doing? And the answer, I suggest, is both. Losing the distinction between learning and doing is one of the keys to increasing innovation. Some of the most remarkable developments in simultaneous learning and doing have been led by the UK. Indeed, I tip my metaphorical hat in the direction of Oxford's Department of Continuing Education and Kellogg College, whom I regard as pioneers in this field. So we can pause to congratulate ourselves, but only briefly, because the change is only just beginning. The internet we use increasingly often to access our virtual worlds of knowledge is a network of interconnected computers. To find the knowledge we seek, we have first to locate the computer that houses it. To do that, we use search engines like Google. Sometimes that experience is less than satisfactory because the internet can be slow and it's tethered to places. But the internet's evolving, and soon the World Wide Web will be an historic curiosity, just like queues outside telephone boxes are waiting for dial tone. And technological and commercial developments already in train will extend the reach of broadband wireless internet services to people, not just places, everywhere. Well, that much is self-evident. But the internet's evolving in less obvious and perhaps more profound ways too. From a network of interconnected computers to a network of things with computers embedded in them. Then eventually to a network of simply things. Some say it won't be long before things have more online services and applications than do people. Not all of the interconnected things will be real. Some will be virtual, like the knowledge banks of the Institution of Engineering and Technology's INSPEC database, and like the web-based professional networks. And those interconnected knowledge banks will be searched not by us, not by search engines driven by us, but by our own personalized learning agents. Learning agents as virtual as the knowledge they search out and piece together for us. Working when we're working and when we're not working. Collaborating with other learning agents, round the clock, tirelessly. Enabling us to take simultaneous learning and doing to a new, barely imaginable high. Engineering fiction? Or engineering fact? Well, not quite fact. Not yet. It's a challenge. Perhaps the challenge for the relatively new, exciting discipline of information engineering. It occurs to me that information engineering today seems to be at about the same stage of advancement as engineering science as was production engineering in the mid-20th century. when its potential as a transforming science was readily apparent, but yet to be realised. At a time when we're increasingly anxious about the future of manufacturing in Britain, could it be that we have within our grasp the beginnings of the, let's call it, the new manufacturing? And could it be that by investing in information engineering now, with the same national determination that previous generations of innovators invested in production engineering, we would be met with equally lucrative success? Could Britain achieve the same global strength in information engineering that once we boasted in manufacturing? Only by trying will we find out. Information engineering is just one of the fields which is generating knowledge that surely every company can use to build competitive advantage. Getting to grips with such potent technologies is easier for some companies than for others, although in absolute terms, it's not easy for any of us. All of us need to have the technology translated so that we can make sense of it in our own industrial worlds. And all of us need universities like this one to help us to do that. The economic growth which results from national industrial strength enables public expenditure to be increased without putting up the percentage tax burden. Then it's a matter of making choices. Health, education, transport infrastructure, and a myriad of other important causes compete for funds. And our democratically elected representatives decide. Theirs is an unenviable task. Ours is to highlight the cyclical nature of innovation and the basic resources upon which that cycle depends and in which we must keep investing as a nation. There are many, such as our communications infrastructure, our science base, and top of my list, skills. Now, I know that we industrialists are famous for complaining about the skills gap, and it's boring. But I've got a particular angle on this issue. A few minutes ago, I voiced the thought that information engineering could turn out to be the new manufacturing. Why? Because manufacturing has always been a matter of making what people will pay for. Whether the product is hard or soft, tangible or intangible, permanent or ephemeral. From the Industrial Revolution until recent times, the products were almost always hard, tangible, and permanent. In the information age, more and more manufactured products will be soft, intangible, and ephemeral. It's a manufacturing future we can all participate in. It's not the preserve of graduates and professionals, but it does require a set of skills which includes maths. Far too many youngsters turn away from maths, even those who are good at it, because they think that to go on with maths, perhaps to A level and beyond, is a hard road to take. And many teachers share that view. It's not difficult to understand why. Maths teachers do a great job. Yet the last time I delved into the statistics, in 2003, 58% of teachers who taught maths to 11 to 18-year-olds were not maths graduates. Indeed, 24% had no post-A-level qualifications in maths at all. They were graduates, but in different subjects. The statistics showed that only 1.7% of maths teaching posts were vacant. Now, if we were to define a vacancy as a post not filled by a teacher with a degree in maths, there would have been 58.7% vacancies. That equates to more than 11,000 teachers. And I think the situation is unlikely to have changed very much since then. Why does it matter? Because it's not easy to be passionate about a subject that you didn't yourself choose to study. Yet that subject is crucial to career success in the information age. So we've got to ask our maths teachers across the length and breadth of the land to help their pupils to see that although maths is hard, it's no harder than any other subject worth pursuing. And that to turn away from maths in their early teens is to deny themselves an information age career. Now, risk. There are two kinds of risk: uncontrollable and controllable. From an investor's perspective, the development of Britain's broadband infrastructure, the state of our science base, and the shortage of maths teachers are examples of uncontrollable risks. They lie outside the business, but still they affect the business. Innovative risk lies mostly inside the business and is much more controllable. Since investors will always weigh the total risk, the uncontrollable plus the controllable risk, the lower they perceive the uncontrollable risk to be, the greater will be the controllable risk that they're prepared to take. So an important secondary effect of investing some of the national wealth in the basic resources necessary to fuel the cycle of innovation, and thereby mitigating the uncontrollable risk, is that it encourages investors to take a less cautious attitude to innovation risk. Every industrialist knows what innovative risk feels like. If you study a good idea for long enough, it turns into a bad idea. Then you walk away from it. And perhaps the best advice is to be found in the standard reference book on information age philosophy, Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. When he was looking for platform 9 3/4 at King's Cross, Harry Potter was advised, "All you have to do is walk straight at the barrier. Don't stop and don't be scared you'll crash into it. That's very important. Best to do it at a bit of a run if you're nervous." That should be our attitude to innovative risk-taking, something best done at a bit of a run. Now, you'd worry if an industrialist talked about innovation without once mentioning regulation. So here it is. Regulation is often seen simply as a brake on the rate of innovation, but that's a one-sided view. Regulation can have a catalytic effect on innovation if it releases new resources or creates choices. And cellular telephony offers, I think, the most dramatic illustration. Today, 2.5 billion people around the world are benefiting from their own personal radios. And not one of them has a license to use their radio. There wouldn't be 2.5 billion, perhaps not even 2.5 million, if each person needed their own transmitting license, as they would have done little more than 2 decades ago. Proof positive of the duality of light touch regulation and innovation. Well, now it's happening again in the new license exempt bands. Innovation in the 2.4 gigahertz band, for example, is seemingly unconstrained. The global market for Wi-Fi alone is reckoned to be worth several billions of dollars. And it's another example of a leading-edge national policy environment here in the UK, creating a leading-edge market. Well, one conclusion is inescapable, I think. The cycle of innovation spins most quickly in national markets, which as a matter of policy are leading edge and lightly regulated. Well, Chairman, that completes the circular tour of innovation in the information age. To maximise the rate of innovation, we've got to make and exercise all of the many hidden connections between innovation, competitive advantage, and growth. There's no one golden key that unlocks the door to innovative success. Michael Faraday recognised that too. His greatest work on electromagnetic induction began with just four words written in the margin of a notebook: convert magnetism into electricity. 9 long years later, he achieved it. And shortly before his death, modest man though all his contemporaries say he was, he wrote, "It puzzles me greatly to know what makes the successful philosopher. Is it industry and perseverance with a moderate proportion of good sense and intelligence? As to genius and its power, there may be cases. I suppose there are. I've looked long and hard for a genius for our laboratory, but have never found one." And he should have looked in the mirror. Today, 140 years later, we should resolve to use the technologies made possible by Faraday's innovations, our information age technologies, to spur on our own innovations. We should resolve, in short, to make the connections. Thank you, Mr. Faraday, for your inspiration. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening.